Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another exciting episode of the Keeping It Real podcast with the M&A Youth Team. Today, we are joined by a very special guest, Blake Desjarlais. Blake was born in Edmonton and raised in the Fishing Lake Métis settlement. Blake made history when he was the first openly two-spirit person and Alberta's only Indigenous member of Parliament to have been elected to the House of Commons. Blake currently serves as the caucus vice chair and critic for Treasury Board, Diversity and Inclusion, Youth Sport and Post-Secondary Education. Blake is the deputy critic for 2S LGBTQIA+, Rights and Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship. So we're super excited to have Blake on today, and we'll head over to that episode right now.
Okay, so we just want to welcome you and thank you for being a guest on our Keeping It Real podcast. So can you please introduce yourself to our audience, Blake?
Well, Tansay friends, Blake Desjarlais Nisagasun, Paktahanse Miskuchiwaskaga not Siniao, Tatamisawake Pitagosania. Really happy to be here, friends. I'm Blake Desjarlais. I'm originally from the Fishing Lake Métis settlement, which is the most easterly Métis settlement in Alberta of the eight Métis settlements, which are unique to our province. And currently I live in Edmonton, Alberta, Miskuchiwaskaga. And I'm the Member of Parliament representing the electoral district of Edmonton-Griesbach, which represents approximately 115,000 residents in Edmonton. And it's a big portion of Edmonton's north and east part of the city, including the inner city where I live in Boyle Street and Macaulay area.
I know where Griesbach is, but I never realized how much you would actually cover. So can you start by telling us a little bit about your Métis roots, your family, your community, kind of anything that would fit into that?
Of course. So I'm really blessed. I was, I'm part of a family and a clan that goes back quite a ways. And there was actually a book written about my family and our family. We're all related. We're all related here in this chat. But it's the book called The People Who Own Themselves. So if you're really curious about exactly where my family came from, there was a book written at the University of Calgary and published there called The People Who Own Themselves. It's an anthropology perspective of where Métis people are from and where they came from through the lens of a case study. And that case study was the Métis family, the Desjarlais family. But from my own knowledge of traditional oral traditions of our family, we used to go by the name, the Cree name, which was also an OG Cree name, Okanes, which is like meaning as strong as bone or the strength of a bone. And at one point, bone was really tough and, nowhere kind of near what metal was like, but that's really the clan that I come from. And the Desjarlais, along with the Droshers and the Putra and Delorme and Laboucan families. I come from two parents of Métis descent, both from Fishing Lake. And so it's two large clans there, the Droshers and the Desjarlais came together. And we have a big clan there and across Alberta. And it's a tiny community, originally St. Paul de Métis, where in Alberta, many people who are listening know that we used to be a Métis Federal Reserve for a lot of our families before we were ultimately displaced and kicked out. And my family ended up settling after that displacement in Fishing Lake, or what we call Pokchawanis, meaning netting lake where you net. And this was a place where many Métis people from St. Paul de Métis would go spend their winters often in order to trap furs and get food and preservatives when they weren't harvesting crops. And so in the summertime, of course, they come back into town and they would have small gardens and they enjoy communal life there. But of course, that was dramatically disrupted, like all Métis families, when the road allowance came in. We were all displaced. We lost all of our wealth. We used to be very powerful and wealthy people. Unfortunately, because of colonization in Canada and displacement, we lost a lot of that wealth and were forced to live on the fringe of society for so long. During our experience in that, I think Métis people really kind of had a renewed sense of who we are on the road allowance. And that really shaped my family, the road allowance time. And during that road allowance time, Métis people, my great-great-grandfather, Charlie Delorme, petitioned the government along with approximately 500 other half-breeds and Métis people around Frog Lake for a land reserves. They said, we need land. We cannot be a people without land. We will not allow us to be barred here. Starting in many ways, a third resistance, a third revolution for the Métis people in Canada, which looked at land rights and exclusive land tenureship for Métis people, especially after what we've seen throughout the Dominion land script and the script systems. And so my family ever since then has been residing on the Fishing Lake Métis settlement, where we've grown, built, and flourished in many ways. And with those, there's other colonies or Métis settlements, 11 others, and four ultimately, unfortunately, were rescinded and dismantled. But that's where I grew up, in the Fishing Lake Métis settlement, with that history and those people. But it took a very long time to get there, of course, and my own sacrifices and my own family sacrifices and trying to maintain our identity. Growing up, I really didn't know the real difference legally between a reserve, like a First Nations reserve, and a Métis settlement. And I know this may be a big shock to many Métis people who are listening, who may not know that Métis people have this kind of experience in Canada. And there's approximately 6,000 Métis people who currently reside on Métis settlements, and they make up the minority today of Métis people in Canada. But that doesn't mean that the traditions, the knowledge, and the history that are founded there are less important. As a matter of fact, I think that Métis lands have an opportunity to reinvigorate and restore Métis people to a point where we are unified and connected to land. I think the disconnectedness that many of the Métis dysphoria since the wars, and even since the onset of the 60s scoop and residential schools that have torn our families apart, can offer a solution to reuniting our nation across the territories and bringing a return to land and a return to land-based teachings, which I think is one of the greatest consequences of colonization. The removal of Métis people from their lands has had disproportionate negative effects on our people across the board, and it created, I think, disunity amongst our people, something I think we're experiencing today. But I don't think we're far from being an obsolete or a conquered people, I guess you can call it. We're far from that. We're very much alive and well. And I think that we are bastions of hope. So growing up there, I remember a lot of common property, for example, many people shared common experiences, common understandings of what poverty meant and what poverty is. But it was in the kind of poverty that you experience in other places in Canada. This poverty was in direct contrast with the wealth, the cultural wealth of the people, and how proud you were to be Métis on the last Métis lands ever. You know, there's something to be said for that kind of endurance and that resilience. Even though we were in many ways destined to poverty and destined to a framework and a system under the Métis Settlements Act that really restricts our ability to gain revenue and gain the kind of wealth that other Métis people have been able to get, even though we have that barrier still today. Like, we still have no clean water in some of the settlements. We still have huge housing issues. We have massive poverty, large cycles of violence, gang violence. You know, we have youth issues. We have identity issues. We have infrastructure issues. You know, these are some of the real things that we have to think about in the Métis settlement often, is how do we pay for a road? Seriously, like, that's a big question. The Métis settlements are large. If you put all the Métis settlements together and put all of Alberta's First Nations reserve together, they're almost identical in size. Métis lands are huge in Alberta, almost the size of Prince Edward Island, the whole province of Prince Edward Island. And Prince Edward Island operates on a $60 billion budget to make sure that their roads, hospitals, schools, and everything can operate. But on a Métis land base, where that land needs support and infrastructure, we see far less, you know, not even 10% of that kind of value, not even 5%, not even 1% of the same value for Métis people in Canada. So the economic disparity is still massive. And Métis people, I'd say, have a lot to learn from our Métis cousins who are off settlement, who've found ways to strive in the economic prosperity that is offered in Canada, and found mechanisms and ways to be strong entrepreneurs. I think there's ways we can complement our nation, and all the solutions are there. I think it's just bringing people together is the big barrier, and making sure we can see across those divides, which I hope that, you know, podcasts like this is doing that for our youth, doing it for Métis people, doing that for our next generation. And that's what makes these so important, which is why I wanted to be here, to highlight that this experience in the settlement is existing, and there's lots to learn and to gain from that experience. But there's also a lot to learn from Métis people in the settlement, from people off the settlement, on how we can truly gain independence economically, gain power economically, and even politically. And so I think I'm excited for that time, but my experience was growing up with the language, growing up with the stories, the creation stories, the importance of land, the importance of clan and family. But the most important part I learned was the importance of Métis laws and the pride that you need in order to ensure that those laws can survive, and to never be ashamed of yourself. You know, that's something Métis people have fought against for a long time, this shame, this punishment for simply being ourselves in Canada. And growing up in the settlement, we didn't have to fear that. We were truly amongst our own people. We were amongst an ideology and a culture, and the whole air was filled with laughter 24/7, even though oftentimes we were mourning together. Well, there's a whole group of people I think that really inspired me. And I think it stems back to probably just the people I grew up with and hearing the stories and even some of the spirits I grew up with. You know, we think about, I'm a spiritual person. I believe in, you know, our old ways of spirituality and the stories. If there's snow on the ground right now, meaning I'm allowed to talk about Wasakechuk, this really important spirit in Métis tradition. And this spirit is in some ways one of the very first lawmakers of Indigenous people, and particularly the Cree and the Métis. And what I mean by lawmakers, I don't mean the kind of lawmakers that we see in Canada, not like a human where we would make sometimes decisions based on selfishness, based on partisanship, based on a whole bunch of things that humans are susceptible to. And we've seen that through human history. Wasakechuk is like a human. He thinks like, in many ways, like a human, has the curiosity of one, but has had the generous benefit of living since we first got here as people, welcoming the very first life here on Turtle Island. And when we talk about stories of Wasakechuk and how he himself came to learn about how we all interact with one another, how we should interact with one another, and the stories of our people and our interactions with him, you learn that there's certain values that have to be upheld. And when Métis people carry those values, I think, and show and demonstrate how those values are exercised, you see there's a huge value there, not just for Métis people, but for all Canadians and really people all over the world. But the question becomes, how do you make sure that Métis people are valued that way? How can we contribute our ideas and our passions and our huge human and natural history that we have as people to the next generation? And it makes me think of the people who've done that already in our history. You know, we know, everyone on this podcast knows who Louis Riel is. Louis Riel was a young person. He was younger than me when he was first elected to lead the Métis people of Manitoba, of the Assiniboia region, of the Red River Métis. He was younger than me, and I'm 28. He was first elected to do that. So young people for the Métis have always led our nation and have always led our pursuit of justice, freedom, liberty, and recognition. And when I think of role models, I think of Louis Riel and his pursuit to remain himself and to remain true to who we are as a people. And I think then of people like Gabriel Dumont, you know, different and distinct of Louis Riel, another Métis leader from Saskatchewan, president of the Métis people there before becoming our ultimate general in the Second Resistance War of 1885. He himself also, you know, someone who demonstrated for Métis people that we are a powerful nation, that we are willing to sacrifice our lives to protect the very idea of being Métis for the next generation. And when I think about that, the uncompromising nature he brought to the table of being proud of who he was, but more importantly, being proud of becoming and being part of this land, is another true aspect I admire and has formulated my ideas of who I should be and what I want to contribute. And then I'd say a couple other really great leaders and people that have inspired me are people like Florence Peronto from the Fishing Lake Métis Settlement. She's an elder, friend with my mom, who's also someone who's remarkable in doing this. And she was an elder who helped to teach me many of the stories. Tell me about the history about the Métis people in our battles. Tell me about how the women and the children in our communities were really the ones to keep our communities together when many of our men were suffering from trauma related to the war, were suffering from trauma related to alcoholism, related to trauma from loss of land, that it was Métis women and those children who did the ultimate job of keeping people together and keeping our nation together. And they're a role model for me. And I'll leave it at this. My family is probably the biggest reason, I guess, is to summarize all this. My family is the reason I do what I do and have been role models to why I entered politics. I never wanted to see Métis people grow up the way I did in many ways, in the sense that, of course, I had a great life on the settlement. I was poor, but we had a good idea of who we are. We were rich in so many other ways. But there was also times I experienced racism, you know, really overt racism. Even in high school, I went to elementary school on the settlement with other Métis people, and it was never an issue. And then at grade 7, I went to Elk Point near St. Paul, for those folks who know. And there I experienced like a whole nother kind of racism, whole kind of othering, a whole kind of discrimination I'd never experienced. And for young people and children to experience that, I think is, we have to end that. And hopefully no one can ever go through that. And I experience it still today. You know, when I went to university for the first time, I faced death threats multiple times, very often, even to the point where people would come to my dorm room and knock on the door and berate me, tell me how terrible I am. And then to ultimately end with, Indians should all die. They should have already died. You know, they're hard to hear those things. And I never wanted to think that my family, who suffered so much to get our next generation to where we are today and have given so much to that reality, I wasn't going to give in to that. And so that, with that in combination with my role models and our history of in my community, motivated me to ultimately enter politics to make sure that things like that can never happen again, to truly stand up for what an inclusive, diverse, and tolerant society could look like, to demonstrate to Canadians that Métis people are far more than the labels they've given us for the last 150 years, that we're truly capable of contributing to this country more than they've given us credit for. And I think that is the lesson that Métis people have continuously tried to echo. However, it hasn't been heard. But I do think things are changing. From the time Louis Riel was elected to our House of Commons and ultimately executed for simply saying the things I'm saying right now, demonstrates to me by evidence that I'm not executed right now, and he was for saying the same thing, that we are truly making changes in our country. It may be slow, and it may be difficult and a bumpy road, but I'm happy that Métis people before me have taken these steps, and they've bushwhacked a path for Métis leaders, particularly young 2SLGBTQI leaders, to get to the point where they can truly influence our society and truly influence what it means to have a diverse, welcoming, and tolerant society, something Métis people have always wanted, not just for our children, but just for ourselves.
See, I just wanted to say, when you were talking about how spiritual you are in the stories, you know, you really do have a gift, and I'm very glad we were able to get you on the podcast, just because the way you talk is so knowledgeable, and it just teaches so many people things, and you definitely have so many gifts, you know, and how you share like the Métis history and everything, you know, and I just wanted to say that to you, just so you know that. And I really enjoyed listening to all this, and we wanted to know about what it's like to be a role of the member of parliament and what like a day looks like for you. Could you share a little bit about that for us?
Oh, what a day looks like in the life of a member of parliament. Well, these days, I'd say they're more extraordinary than they are ordinary. But in many ways, I'm not certain if there ever was an ordinary day for a member of parliament. So many of my duties or what my daily life looks like is, you know, I'll wake up, before a day even starts, a day beforehand, I'll look at my calendar. And I have to make mention of this. When we talk about Blake as a member of parliament, there's a whole team, a whole institution behind me. And Paige is one of those people in my staff. The remarkable parts of our team. And I don't do anything in a silo, and I don't do anything ever alone. It's so important for me to have the consistent advice, care, and knowledge of my staff. And they truly are people who want to see things better for the country, want to see things better for Edmonton Griesbach, want to see things better for Indigenous people. And without that kind of support, being a member of parliament is not possible. And so there's a lot of multitasking and a lot of duties that a member of parliament has. But I'm so fortunate and lucky that I have very capable people who are able to administer, organize, and tackle some of these issues. And we work together in a collaborative way to come up with the best result. And so before a day even starts, sometimes weeks or months in advance, we're taking requests for meetings and our House of Commons duties. And so when I think about what my day looks like, it really depends on a couple of things. One, whether it's a House of Commons duty day or a constituency day. Those are the only two kind of days I have, where I'm dealing directly with people in my community that I care about, that I want to hear from, or I'm advocating on those very same people in Ottawa. Those are the two core roles of a member of parliament, is to listen to the people that I represent, who are my neighbors, who live in Edmonton, Griesbach, which is a big part of what Paige does. And I do a lot of work related to making sure we advance the policy perspectives and really important ideals of the country moving forward and bringing that to the House of Commons. And so it depends if it's one of those 2 days. And so I'll look at my calendar the day before and I'll set an alarm on my phone as to when I have to wake up. Because the thing is, you value your time as a member of parliament and you sometimes don't finish until 1 o'clock in the morning. If you know you're going to finish at 1 o'clock in the morning, it's like, okay, you better allow yourself to sleep in till, you know, give yourself 8 hours or 6 to 8 hours of sleep. You try to do that no matter what your calendar looks like. And so I try to do that. I look at my calendar and sometimes I start at 6 a.m., meaning I got to go to bed at 9, and sometimes neither is possible. So my first step is always to get a coffee. Paige knows this. I can't live without a coffee. You know, I just, my emails, what I'm hearing, it just doesn't work. It just, for some reason, my mind is filled with just like, I need caffeine. And so I get a really good coffee and treat myself in a good way. And then I smudge, typically either right before or right after. Sometimes it's quick, sometimes it's not, depending on how much time I have. But I think it's important to use medicine in our lives, because especially as someone who has responsibility to family, friends, or even the country like myself, whenever you're dealing in a position of caring for others, it's so important that you come to that with a clear mind, a clear heart, and a clear spirit, because you're going to be making decisions on behalf of other people. You're going to be thinking about issues and having that trust that other people rely on you for. So I think it's really valuable to have that strength of medicine, because it's bringing in, inviting the elders in to making sure that we have the strength and the tools we need to get the work done. And so I have my coffee, I have a good smudge, and then I'll usually read the briefing notes for the day, look at my calendar and look at every single meeting I have, go through the brief. Paige or some of the other staff will contact me, let me know if there's anything coming up that I should be aware of, and we get through the day together. And sometimes that means going to the House of Commons and having debates that are really tough, like the debate we're having right now in Canada, related to what freedom is, related to what liberty is, related to our healthcare system, related to national security. These are really serious issues that Métis people, I know, including myself and everyone listening, can contribute to, and we should be in those spaces. So I'm really honored to have those kinds of day-to-day experiences. And one of my favorite things to do in a day, I think, is at the very end of the day, I like to look back at the day and think about what I learned and how I learned it and what that's going to mean for me going forward. I think that reflection time is really important too, not just for members of parliament, but for everyone. You know, if you ever watch that movie, it's a British film. I forget what it's called. About Time. If you ever watch About Time, it's kind of a corny classic rom-com, or not rom-com. Well, maybe it's a rom-com a bit. But if you ever watch it, it's called About Time. It's about this like redheaded guy who can go back in time. And he relives every single day of his life many times, spoiler alert. He learns that it's really important to look at the little things in life and to look about how important it is to reflect on those things. Because oftentimes a second glance means the difference between whether you think you had a good day or a bad day. And I think when I look at things, even though what we're dealing with, what I deal with as a member of parliament, is sometimes really devastating realities and really devastating news. Like, for example, in Saskatchewan, we've just found another 53 Indigenous children, residential school children who never survived. There's ways to look at that still and know that things are going to be okay without immediately resorting to how terrible that reality is. Knowing that, for example, that those children are now home. They're being honored. They're being cared for. They're being loved. That's a good perspective too. And that's the perspective of healing that I think a second glance offers, and one that I try to do most of my life and try to do it every single day. So that's my day. Coffee, teamwork, and then reflection. Well, great question, Skylin. Thanks.
But your day has so much filled in it. Like, that's amazing, you know? And I definitely, after you said that, you know, I think everyone should do that. Take a reflection of their day and what they learned and what they can do better and what they want to do tomorrow. And that's awesome, Blake.
Have faced and experienced so far since being elected?
Highlights and challenges, Brian. That's a great question. I think there's highlights and challenges in nearly almost everything. But I'd say one of the best highlights so far has been this really controversial law that has been controversial in Canada for a really long time. And it's so unfortunate because a lot of people have died under conversion therapy, something that has existed in Canada for a very long time. And for those who don't know what conversion therapy is, conversion therapy is the oftentimes coercive practice of ensuring or pushing or peer pressuring the 2S LGBTQ community members, particularly when they are in their youth, to ultimately enter institutions, practices, programs, or other settings where they would be told it is bad, sinful, or inappropriate to be a member of the 2S LGBTQI community, and that they attempt to, quote unquote, break this portion of them. This is synonymous and similar in many ways to what had happened in residential schools. Although I'm not conflating the two experiences, they're certainly both different. There are similarities where conversion therapy was a forced practice that tried to stop someone from being who they were, similar to residential schools. They want to kill the Indian in the child. And for the conversion therapy survivors, they felt as though that these institutions wanted to break them and kill them as well. And in many cases, many people did die, ultimately by mental health impacts and trauma impacts of that experience. And later on, after their youth, they would ultimately make the ultimate decision to kill themselves, a practice that is well documented, well known by survivors of the 2S LGBTQI community as a leading contributing factor to suicide. And this has existed in Canada for a long time. When I ran in Edmonton Griesbach, the member of parliament who sat here in previous, this is a traditional conservative stronghold where I won. He was a member who was really adamantly opposed to 2S LGBTQI rights, in particular conversion therapy. He fought against it and was a member of the 63 conservative coalition members who voted against conversion therapy. Something that really hurt members of my community and hurt a lot of people across the country to think that we don't want you. We don't think you should be who you are. And we want to maintain permissions for the system is what it told many people. And so one of my big highlights was when we first started getting to work on this in the 44th Parliament, Randall Garrison, one of our senior members of our caucus, he's our critic for justice and is a member of the 2S LGBTQ community and has fought for survivors of conversion therapy rights for a long time, including the ban of conversion therapy. We worked really hard to convince both the opposition, the conservatives, and the liberals, the government, that this was important to pass and to do it really fast because it's been going on forever. And so finally, Bill C-4, the liberals, a motion from the conservatives, actually, in a really historic unanimous consent way, we all unanimously, every single member of parliament, 338 of us, agreed to end this dispute, this historic long deadlock that hurt many people in Canada and contributed to their deaths, to end that practice of conversion therapy and officially ban it in Canada, banning conversion therapy and making it illegal for persons to coerce or attempt to coerce or pressure persons who are 2S LGBTQI, particularly youth, into systems that would otherwise force them to be someone they're not. And so that is a huge highlight for me. I was able to contribute to the passage of a bill that hurts people, something that I feel adamantly proud about, because I think being a member of parliament, particularly an Indigenous member of parliament, an Indigenous Two-Spirit member of parliament, my role is more about harm reduction. I see my participation in parliament as harm reduction. I know I'm not going to fix everything. I know that there's no silver bullet to many things, but I do know that if I can save lives by stopping the government in the inappropriate exercising of its laws and authorities, we are going to save lives. And that's what banning of conversion therapy did. We made criminal that practice, which was previously legal, and we're going to save lives with it. One of the challenges, I'd say, of being a member of parliament has been the partisanship. You know, we're seeing that right now in Canada, probably more divided now than it has been since for a very long time. And this division has been growing, maybe not growing and growing, but becoming more noticeable and more noticeable. You know, white supremacy and racism has existed in Canada ever since its founding. It's seen in the Louis Riel wars. It's seen in our treatment and internment of Japanese Canadians, Ukrainian Canadians, and so many more. We've seen these inappropriate exercising of power to harm people and to hurt people in the country. And I see a huge division in our country between this historic idea of what Canada is for some people and where many people are today, which is trying to make a Canada that's better for all. This idea is really coming to a, these two positions are really coming to a head right now. Traditional, I guess you could say, old stock and barrel Canadians who believe that their rights are foundational to their participation in settling the land and want to have, in many ways, a Canada that's Eurocentric, a British Canada, for example, something that has existed in Canada for a long time, versus this kind of world, this society where it's tolerant, inclusive, free, and secular, one where we can truly be a democracy. These ideas are coming to a head, I think, and that's probably been the most challenging part for me, is navigating where people are coming from on that discussion, because technology and influence of individuals has become so ingrained in our technology, social media, and our systems. It's creating vacuums. It's creating vacuums across our society and across our spectrum. But I'm really hoping that throughout this challenge, we learn more and more about how we can bring people together and how we're going to unify. And I think being Métis is one of the greatest gifts to that challenge. We know exactly what it's like to bring worlds together. And I think now is more important that our perspective is heard more than ever.
There we go. Wow, that's been like such a huge, like, I can only imagine how you must have felt when that bill went through. Are the first openly two-spirited member of parliament. So if you're comfortable, could you tell us what being two-spirited is, as some of our viewers and listeners might actually not know what it means?
Of course. So I'll start with the definition part. And so for a very long time, I'll start with two ways of addressing that question. What is two-spirit? One, first of all, the definition, just what it is in terms of a raw definition. So being a two-spirit person is unique of the 2SLGBTQI community. And it's a moniker and an identifier that is unique for Indigenous people and is an homage and connection to our historic spiritual and community roles. And what that means is we are not simply queer. We are also persons of power, responsible, part of a two-spirit identity. Is understanding that it's also a spiritual identity. It's rooted in our culture and our place in our society, in a big way. And to give the history of the two-spirit term, in the late 1980s and early 90s, I forgot her name right now, an Indigenous elder, a two-spirit Indigenous elder, had a vision. You can find it on YouTube. I just remembered her name. But check out the Edmonton Two-Spirit Society for more information. They have all the links to this too, and they're good friends over there doing really good work. But she had a prophecy where she brought to Regina, a Regina LGBTQI conference, and she spoke about the need for a unique space for Indigenous people, because the overarching American and Eurocentric LGBTQ movement in the 80s leading to the 90s was really one of separation and distinctness of white society. It was about the LGBTQ movement in white society. And the two-spirit community really felt isolated and not part of this movement, which sought to actually draw from tradition, draw from history, and draw from our historical place pre-colonization, which leads me to my second point on this. It's really important that we see two-spirit identity as a framework, more than a definition, for who people are. And what I mean by that framework is, we'll do an exercise together. If all your listeners, for example, just took a moment to think about what the year 1491 looked like before contact. 1491 was a world where Indigenous people were highly diverse, not just in language, culture, and spirituality, but they were also diverse in sexuality and gender expression. The word, for example, the Cree word Testowinuak, means the people who are in between, in direct reference to this idea of Europe, of having the binary. This, if you are a woman, this is what a woman is, someone who has this particular genitalia and these particular roles and obligations in Western society. And then we also have a male, someone who is the principal of property ownership, power, and prestige in this system, and it created a power vacuum in many ways, very different than how Indigenous people understood themselves. And that history and experience in Europe has been exported by colonization across the globe, that there's this idea of two genders based on two sexes. In the Cree tradition, in many ways, we have at minimum five genders. At minimum five genders. And these five genders interact in a really unique way that respond to community need and place of importance in community. So similar to Western society where there's defined roles, there's also defined roles in our gender system, but they're just more roles and more genders in order to reduce the caste of this and to level out the playing field for power. So so being Two-Spirit is a combination of these two modern and historic perspectives, of bringing in this historic perspective of how we value our gender and how we value our sexuality as a historical and traditional place of power and belonging, but also understand that Two-Spirit is a modern term to distance and to make a unique home for Indigenous queer people in the overall 2S LGBTQI movement. It's a special place for us to live so that we can have these discussions about how tradition, indigeneity, sexuality, gender, and roles means for Indigenous people. And so it's a unique moniker for us and a unique moniker for me. And I'm really proud to be a Two-Spirit person and Alberta's or Canada's first Two-Spirit member of parliament to bring those perspectives, because I think it's so important that we have this in our parliament, just not in our parliament, but across all sectors of leadership. I think it can unite us and bring us to a better place in our world. We know, for example, women in Europe, this is a study in Europe, they require women to be on peace and treaty negotiations in Europe today in instances of war, because they know that having women on in those discussions is actually how you guarantee peace. It's a fact that we need to have a diverse gender expression in leadership positions. And this is a really big movement towards that in Canada, one I'm really proud of. And so I say, I know it's a long, very complicated answer, but there's lots of resources there. And it's really exciting for those who are really interested in exploring their own identity. There's good resources. And I can talk about it all day, but great question.
What inspired you to be so open about being Two-Spirited, and how do you deal with people that have negative views on it?
Good question.
We think that's like a great question to ask, because there's lots of Métis youth that I feel like don't feel so confident, and like seeing a role model like you will encourage them to feel confident.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's actually the answer to Skylin is why I'm confident and identifying as a Two-Spirit person is because I know that the gifts and leadership of other Two-Spirit people in my life have given me empowerment. You know, my sister, for example, my older sister is a Two-Spirit person, and she's a role model for me in my life. And she always showed me that she would rather 10 out of 10 times be laughed at, ridiculed, made fun of, than to betray herself. It was a question of who she was willing to betray. Was she going to betray the people that she hung out with from, you know, 20 minutes to 3 hours a day, the people who really didn't care about her and want to know who she was, because they, of course, had these perspectives? Or would she betray herself? You know, a very proud, Indigenous, Two-Spirit person that her ancestors have fought for to just be here in this place and to be authentic to yourself is to understand our relationship with our ancestors. You know, it's that pride comes from a place of survival. And my pride and my confidence in who I am comes from that very same place of where our ancestors were from. They could have simply rolled over and said, fine, I'm just going to be white. Fine, I'm just going to speak English. Fine, I'm just going to forget about our traditions and all of our history and all of our national traits that make us unique, including unique gender and sexuality expression. We're going to forget all of it and adopt all of these settler colonial mentalities. But they didn't. You know, they overtly rejected that and said, we would rather die who we are, unique and free, than to submit to being something we aren't. Because we knew exactly what that would lead to. We knew it would become our own destruction in the end anyway. And so I'm so proud to be Métis, because it makes me proud to be Two-Spirit, and they're all connected. And it's all about our identity and how we are. We must be proud as a nation for not only how diverse we are, but to recognize that diversity as a strength. It truly is. If that strength will will defend our nation for generations to come when we have the tools amongst our own people to offer the world a compassionate and inclusive society that cares for one another beyond our own individual identities, beyond the identities that may divide us. That's what makes a strong nation, and that's what makes us a unique people. And so just like the beaded vest I'm wearing right now and all the beaded and beautiful art Métis people have, there's a message in that art. Every time you see those flowers, every time you see that beading, know that no other beadwork looks like that. No other bead is placed in the same place as another bead more than once. And that's what Métis people are. We're unique, we're vibrant, we're beautiful, and we should be proud of that. And I encourage, especially all those persons thinking right now, you know how hard it might be to tell your family, to tell your loved ones, to understand what it means to be a member of the 2SLGBTQQI community. There are resources. You're not alone. And you have to know that who you are and how special you are. People died so that you can be who you are. And you're going to be loved no matter what. You know, our nation is a compassionate one. We've seen our people fall to the absolute despairs of their last legs in their life. And we never turn them away. And we're not going to turn back on you now, even if there's tough roads ahead. There are going to be Métis people who lift you up. There are going to be Métis people who see you. There are going to be Métis people who welcome you into the nation. But we have a long ways to go. You're right, Skyland, there are barriers still today to ensuring that Métis people can live the life that they are destined to, which is free and limitless and one that can flourish in a mosaic of beautiful flowers like I just spoke about. And I think that to them, they will get there, you know, and I hope that they can inspire, like I've been inspired by other two-spirit persons like my sister or my cousins or some of the remarkable people in our own history that are two-spirit that can, in fact, demonstrate to us that there's a way forward for two-spirit people in the Métis culture and in Métis society because it's foundational to our people.
You should make a YouTube. I would like watch it like every day of you just talking.
Maybe I'll make a podcast. No.
Yeah. I know. This is like, I hope our listeners feel like the sense that like I feel right now. Like I honestly just feel like so happy for the future and everything that you're going to accomplish, Blake, and that, you know, that our youth are going to accomplish. And I just hope that they feel just as inspired as I do right now when they're listening to this podcast.
Oh, you guys inspire me. Young Métis inspire me. You know, because I definitely can't do it alone. Like I just see Métis people surviving out there. I'm like, geez, keep doing it. And that's what gives me energy.
That's amazing. So do you have any advice for our listeners who might be wanting to explore a career in politics? Kind of, you know, how they could get started, what to look out for, stuff like that.
Good question. I think to get started, it always, especially politics, to get involved in politics, you have to have a foundation of public service, and you have to know that being involved in politics is ultimately to be involved in community building and community organizing. And politics is a big fancy way to describe that process. And some people abuse politics in a way that it's not reciprocal. But Indigenous people have shown me throughout my own experience of working in Indigenous governance and working for the Métis settlements in particular. You know, I worked in my local Métis settlement at a public service level all the way up to the executive level of the Métis Settlements General Council. And then even today I work in the federal government, which we deal with a tremendous amount of stakeholders related to Métis people and other Indigenous nations' access to justice and politics and power. But to me, what I think is good advice to going into politics is to ground oneself in why you're doing it. You need to know that you are powerful and that you can make change. But change is really a process that requires people more than just yourself, requires compassion, listening, and unity. These are really important qualities that will be a strong foundation in any political career. If you look at all issues from a public service perspective, knowing that I'm not against anyone, I'm here to listen to everyone, is a really good place to start, because you're going to have people come up to you with opinions that are going to be conflicting, are going to be opposite, are going to be even completely in disagreement with yours. But what makes a very good measure of a good person in politics is their ability to engage with that person in a way that they can express their opinion, their emotion, and their ideas, while also granting you that space. And even more so, the ability to then translate what they've said and what you've said into a position of unity. That's what organizing is, and that's what real power comes from. That's what many people have done for a long time. We're masters at this. We had people who spoke completely different languages. Louis Riel did a very hard job when he got involved in politics, which is still the message today. He took 20 French-speaking parishes and 20 English-speaking parishes, him belonging to the French parish, and said, we need to sit together. We need to have one house, one home, so that we can debate in any native tongue you wish, whether it's your indigenous tongue, your French tongue, or an English tongue. We can communicate and we can make a difference. We can unify to ensure that common principle and the common good prevails. And I think that if you come to the table, any young person comes to the table and says, that's what I want to do, there's ways to do it. You can get involved. You can volunteer in local electoral district associations, for example. You can volunteer with how electoral district associations operate. You know, I have an electoral district association, for example. You folks can join that. Every MP, everyone in Canada is home to an electoral district association, a group of people who live in a community and volunteer their time to ensure that they can support a candidate for federal or provincial election that inspires them, that does the work that they want them to do, that ensures that collaboration at the community level is possible. And that's one really strong way to get involved. Another really good way is to just simply spend time with people who need help. You know, you will find that when you help others, there's a need and a human process inside of all of us where we receive something from the giving of our time. We receive a genuine return in comfort and value for who we are as individuals. And you have to enjoy that kind of reciprocal gratitude, because that is what politics is about for those who exercise it, is about ensuring that you can get to a point where someone's issue has been solved or someone's problem has been solved, and then feeling good about that. Because if you don't feel good about the things you do, no matter what they are, they might not be worth doing and it might not be your gift. And that's okay too. It's about finding that gift. It's about knowing where that gift is and finding common ways to exercise that gift. And so I think if that works for you and that pathway to politics sounds good for you, then I think you're going to probably like politics writ large. But if you're part of a group of people who think, you know, talking to others is too hard, or maybe you're introvert, you know, there's many good introvert politicians, by the way. But there's unique ways to having to deal with that part of interacting with others. You just got to find that within yourself. But that's the common, I think, way to get involved. Spend time in community, spend time with others, and especially others who you may not agree with at times, so that you know how diverse opinions can be, so that you know how diverse solutions can be as well. Volunteer with the M&A. That's a good one too. The M&A is a good political body.
Yeah, that's great. Like, that's great advice. And I really feel like the people who are listening can take that advice. And if they really do want to get into politics, those are great starting steps. We have one last question that I wanted to ask, and it's kind of like an open floor question. Do you have any personal advice that you want to give to our Métis youth, and it could be about anything? Because I kind of know we asked you questions about politics and being two-spirited. So it's kind of like whatever you want the youth to know, this is your personal message.
My personal message is probably that of kindness. You know, we're really living in a world right now where kindness is fleeting, and those moments of togetherness are far more rare. And I think Métis people, we're used to gathering, we're used to having fun, we're used to dancing and sharing stories, big laughs, big meals. And a lot of that's been missing the last few years, especially with COVID-19 and Omicron recently. And people are feeling really down, you know, really sad and really having a tough time right now. You know, mental illness is at an all-time high. People are scared. People are nervous about what's going to happen in the future, whether or not we're ever going to get back to normal, for example. And I think the best thing we can do right now, while people are going through this terrible, terrible time. And for many, this is the hardest time of their life, that we remain compassionate. We remain kind. We remain truly people who care for other people, because the world right now wants to tear us apart. You know, COVID wants to tear us apart and is doing that. COVID's more than just a disease that affects our immune system. But the elders sometimes describe COVID as also a spirit that has malicious intents, that wants to divide, that wants to hurt, that wants to cast doubt on people's lives. But we have to remain united. We have to know that we can stay together even if we disagree. We can be united in the face of dark times, even if we're both sad, if we're all sad. That Métis people, we've endured a lot, even worse times than the one we're experiencing now. And you want to know what got us through it? Was kindness and love for one another. We didn't even have food at many points, but we still offered our last piece of bannock and our last bit of tea to those who needed it most. And if we take that level of compassion and care into everything we do, especially right now, we're going to survive this. And there's going to be a time where we're all going to go back, and hopefully, you know, it could be a few months or maybe even a year before we get back to, you know, quote unquote normal, but we can get there. Please, we need to have more kindness. We need to have people stand united with positivity until we do. You know, this is a terrible and terribly difficult time, and I think we have it in us. And let's show them, you know, let's show the world how they get through a dark time, because we certainly as a people have been through many.
Truly wonderful.
Thanks so much, Brighton. Thanks so much, Skyline. Really great seeing you all. And can't wait to see what Métis Youth get up to next. And I can't wait to see you all in person sometime soon, hopefully. And then be kind. I agree.
Thank you again for listening to this episode of the Keeping It Real podcast with the M&A Youth Team. We sure hope you enjoyed this episode with Blake Desjarlais. We just wanted to give a quick shout out to the upcoming Alberta Métis Fest. We are pleased to announce that it's going to be back in person June 25th from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. up at Métis Crossing. You can show off your skills with our all-ages jigging competition, enjoy regional showcases by talented performers from across the province, shop local, and explore the Métis artisan market, and keep the kids entertained at all the children and youth activity tents. There is fun for the entire family to enjoy. We can't wait to gather again in person and celebrate our culture the only way we know how, together. Check out the website for more information through albertametis.com/events/AlbertaMétisFest2022. And you can also find the link in our social media bios on Instagram and in our posts on Facebook. Thank you again, and we'll see you next time.